Hi, this is Laura Semp, author of The Clackety, and you are listening to the HP Lovecast podcast.
Hello, and welcome to HP Lovecast Presents Transmissions, where we collect brief interviews by creators of new or upcoming projects. We'll open with a guest reading an excerpt from their project, and then follow up the interview proper. Transmissions posts on the last day of each month. I'm Nicholas Dyack, pop culture scholar of Peplum Films, industrial music, horror studies, and the editor of The New Peplum from McFarland.
And I am Michelle Brittany, editor of James Bond in Popular Culture, and the Bram Stoker-nominated Horror in Space. I write on all things pop culture with special emphasis on horror, fantasy, and spy genres. Nicholas and I co-edited Horror Literature from Gothic to Postmodern, also from McFarland.
Our first transmission is from weird fiction author Michael Sisko. Sisko has written a plethora of short stories and books, such as The Divinity Student, The Great Lover, Unlanguage, and his first nonfiction book, Weird Fiction, a Genre Study, was published last year and is on the Bram Stoker ballot. Sisko joins us today to talk about his newest novel, Pest. Welcome, Michael.
My name is Chalo. Somewhere, my story is being told. It's like someone, a stranger, is keeping a promise made to me, since I can't tell my own story now. And since I neither need to tell my own story to myself, nor want to hear it. I used to be a man. Now I'm a yak. I remember a human childhood. I remember all too well my sham adulthood. I don't remember old age. I could just be dreaming a uniquely long, detailed, complicated dream. My life as a yak is actually more complicated than my life as a human being, and since I find that hard to believe, I doubt the reality of my circumstances. Maybe it only seems more complicated. Since I don't know if I can trust my interpretations of things, I'd have to live both lives at once to compare them. Oh yeah, then I'd doubt both. More to doubt then. Feed my doubt habit.
We are joined this evening with Michael Sisko. Michael, it is fantastic to see you. How are you doing,
good
sir?
You. I'm doing well. How are you?
Oh, we're doing really good over here. Yeah. It's awesome to talk to you. I know we're here to talk about Pest, but we'd be remiss if we didn't bring up that Weird Fiction, a Genre Study, is on the Bram Stoker ballot. So congrats.
Thank you very much.
I think we maybe take a quick little segue to ask, can you tell us about that book real quick? So that way, if there's any voting members listening, maybe they'll be enticed.
So it was published by Palgrave Macmillan last year. It's an academic book it's a genre study of weird fiction. So it was my attempt to come up with some kind of definition of what makes weird fiction. So it consists of a few more theoretical chapters at the beginning, and then better than half the book is case studies of various different works of weird fiction from around the world, as best I could put them together. And the basic thesis is that, not to get too deep into it, but just that, we can analyze weird fiction and come up with certain attributes that the genre seems to possess pretty stably. And I'm fully expecting to get critiqued, and, I'm not expecting this to be an eternal and perfect definition, but it's an attempt. But it really centers around an event that disrupts the ordinary or the normal. So it's something that invades or disrupts the normal, so that weird is not understood as something in itself, but in a relationship to the ordinary that it throws off, and that it sort of answers a desire, not just to be afraid or something like that, but a, It responds to a feeling of being kind of caught in ordinary circumstances, being too circumscribed and limited, and want and both wanting and fearing that there may be something more or something outside. That's the general gist of it.
I think we need to pick up a book for our arsenal. We're academic writers on our end too, although I do sword and sandal films. And
Sure.
what are your fortes, Michelle?
I don't know. Just kind of all over.
Yeah, silent films and mummies. But, you know, we do all the successor Lovecraft stuff on this podcast. And so the idea of not just cosmic horror pops up, but also bizarro fiction and weird fiction pops up. So definitely need to dive into that. So crossing fingers that it proceeds and gets an award.
I'm happy to just be nominated. I did not expect that to happen. So I'm already very much satisfied having a nomination. Not that I would turn down an award if I got it, but I mean, certainly being nominated enough is honor enough. I mean, it was a total surprise.
Well, if you ever run into, is it Scott Eidelman? He gives people Subway punch cards that have been nominated. So, you know, 10 yes. nominations equals one Stoker.
Yep. I've met Scott Edelman. He used to go to ReaderCon a lot. I think once ReaderCon gets back on its feet again, he'll probably be back as well.
We're here for Pest, your very newest novel. So tell us about that. What's the 1,000-foot view, you know, plot summation of Pest?
Okay. Well, I mean, it's not an easy book to sum up, but basically it's a book about a character who he's a civil engineer. It's just set in basically our world, but things are going awry. And then again, they're going awry here. So, but in any case, he's hired by a kind of guru, basically, who has predicted that some sort of being is going to visit the Earth. Is going to come to Catalina Island specifically at some point in the near future. And he wants a group of people to be there ready to receive this person and to undergo whatever transformation or receive whatever message is coming. And he wants to build a campus on the island for these people to ready themselves and train and so on. And he's hired our protagonist to design it. And he's an engineer. But this gives him a chance to do some architecture. So this is a dream, like a chance to build several different buildings and make some sort of permanent lasting statement. Whether he believes what this guy is talking about is another matter. But in any case, so the story follows him and their struggles to achieve this goal on the one hand, but also at some point along the way, possibly by dint of reincarnation or some mechanism like that, he has also somehow become an adult male Himalayan yak, a wild yak in the Himalayas. And the rut is coming, the spring is coming, and he's somehow having to deal with that. And so the book kind of bilocates back and forth between his life as a civil engineer, would-be architect, and a wild Himalayan yak. And that's the story, pretty much.
I gotta ask, have you drawn from other like cult type stuff in SoCal area? You know, I think of like Hale Bopp and Heaven's Gate.
Oh, sure. I mean, that stuff has always fascinated me a lot. Again, if we go back to what I was saying about weird fiction, there's this idea of saying there has to be more, or things are too limited, and wanting to get out or to leave. I mean, with a cult, you have something more like someone will actually tell you what's on the other side and start explaining it and give you rules. Weird fiction doesn't really do that. But anyway, yeah, I mean, Southern California in particular is very heavily associated with cults and strange religious movements. And, you know, they were just around. You know, like I grew up in the 70s. And so I think I was dimly aware of the Manson family as it happened. I mean, I was very young, but it might have been dimly there. And when I was a kid, too, there was the whole McMartin preschool trial where they were accusing these teachers of being secret Satanists and so forth. And there was a kind of the satanic panic you might have heard of. That all was sort of going on in the background. And that had a really that did have a big effect on me, because, you know, you started to doubt that everything was what it seemed like. You'd pass a school and you'd wonder, well, what's really, is that a school or is that something else, or are people what they seem? So it kind of was give you a crash course in paranoia, But you know, then that just grew into an interest in these phenomena in general, and people like Jim Jones in particular. And so, yeah, I've written a lot about cults and charismatic cult leaders and so on, and trying to write about them. You know, not just demonizing them though, to try to understand what the impulse is. I'm trying to remember, there was a movie, was it The Eternal? Do you know the movie I'm talking about? It was a sort of Lovecraftian film about two brothers who got out of a cult.
Oh yes, I know what you're talking about. I do not remember the name of the movie though. It came out in the last I'm going to say 4 years. I know what
Yeah, it was
you're
pretty
talking about.
recent. Not a big, not a studio film, but you know, it was still a really well-made, thoughtful film. So that kind of thing is that it's more that kind of thing, more sort of a I'm trying to understand what the appeal is, what the psychology is, that kind of thing. So that is in there.
Yeah, I think you and I are probably about the same generation, and I do recall as I was growing up how many different occult things were going on in the 70s and 80s, probably up into the 90s. So I think we were at a very informative time with regards to those. So based on your synopsis about pests, I'm sure all of our listeners are wondering right along with me, how did you come about with that story? What was your
So
genesis for it?
it kind of gelled in, and the main thing that got me, I guess, is thinking about, reading about Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism. I especially find very, very interesting, largely just from an aesthetic point of view. I really like the music and the art and the storytelling, and that was sort of in the back of my head. But I've also always been really interested in stories about animals, from like Charlotte's Web through Watership Down. There's something about writing about animals that gets you to a very pure place emotionally very quickly, without a lot of human trappings to get in the way. You can just kind of get to the emotional crux of things so quickly. And somehow, out of all that, I get the idea of a Tibetan yak with a human mind, sort of reflecting back on a human life, which is now done or inaccessible. And there was something very poignant somehow about that that I couldn't. And I didn't want to define or figure out. I just wanted to be in it and feel it and talk out of it. And so that's sort of basically where it came from. And then it just pulled in a lot of my usual preoccupations and concerns and, whatever I happened to be thinking about at the time, into this tangle that turned into pest.
So, what were some of the challenges you encountered while writing Pests compared to the other works in your canon?
So part of it is just making it gel, making all these different parts fit together in a way that feels organic and not forced. So there were times when I would start to wonder if I needed to give other characters more air, and whether I wanted to, did I want to go into certain directions with social commentary? So that had to do, it's like there were a lot of little sliders that I was sort of adjusting, like how much of this, how much of that. Not that I had in such precise control, but there were a lot of these little decisions that went into making up the whole thing. So yeah, the challenges had to do too with just how those two halves dovetail, in particular, the yak, life as a yak and life as a man. And like, if they have nothing to do with each other, then the whole thing just becomes this shallow, arbitrary exercise. It only works if each one reflects on the other in a way that's surprising, interesting, and enlightening, and tells us something about something that's relatable, something you can care about or feel, or something that an audience member can feel. So, I'm not someone who doesn't think about the reader when I write. I'm trying to think about how to communicate something to them in a way that will be surprising and new, and that's always a challenge, really. So, but with each book, it takes on a slightly different character.
I have this vision of you like a sound mixer, like at the board, and like, give me more yak here, give me a little less over here.
A little like that, yeah.
So I imagine maybe you were channeling yak, but what was some of the things that you learned through the process of writing Pest?
The one thing in particular that kind of happened that was sort of special there, there's Kafka says somewhere that the book has to be the axe that breaks the frozen ice of the frozen sea inside you, or something like that. And you know, that's the kind of thing you read and you think, oh yes, of course, and it makes sense. But it's like you don't. But in this book in particular, there were a few moments where I felt like oh, that's what he meant. Like that there. Moments where I really felt like, in all this sort of tumult of ideas and thinking and so forth, speaking with this character, I got to something that felt like it was very emotionally real and direct. Something that was like hard to say, something that was honest, something that felt, you know, that wasn't, how do I put it? Something that was just very like, that I couldn't say any other way, as you can see, as I struggle to say it now. You know, so it's not something that's just tacked on or slapped on top of a narrative. It bursts out, and there's something about it that's like really real. Like there's a part where the character is talking about not wanting, don't basically asking the other characters not to abandon him. And it's about this feeling of being abandoned and being very this feeling about being alone. And it's like this was not a contrivance. Like this was something that felt like it was coming from real lived experience. And I've done that other places in my books, but here I really saw it in terms of what Kafka was talking about there. And I'm not trying to compare myself with him. It's like but he's a genius, and so I try to understand what he did. And since then, I've tried to find those moments more, a little bit more specifically, find moments like that in stories or in books where something really sincerely, vividly emotional and real comes out. That really helps the reader find the emotional core or the relatable part of the story. So that's the main thing I think I learned from this one.
Well, do you think you were able to accomplish
Well, I did it at least in that one place. You know, it's like,
that?
you know, writing a whole book at that pitch of intensity would be painful and exhausting and very hard to read for a reader, I think. You know, if you don't want to read like an in intense poem that goes on for hundreds of pages, you know, that's a lot to ask someone to read. And I don't mind giving people tough reading, but there needs to be a good reason to do something like that. And so, but I feel like I've been doing it more and been. It's very hard to do because it's about being honest about how you feel, which is the hardest thing to do. You know, and so it's not something you just do casually. So finding ways to cause that, you know what I mean? It's not like I can just choose to do it. I could just like, oh, I'm just going to speak my mind or whatever. It's something that has to come about through this interactions of characters and circumstances, and then it emerges. So I think I've gotten a little bit more deliberate in doing that. So I think I have learned how to do it better.
I
Yeah,
think we
that's.
understand, like you were saying earlier about animals and how there's a simplicity about animals because they don't have the same kind of baggage that we as humans do. But they are still sentient. They still have thoughts and feelings, just at a different level. And I could see where there's almost a moment of enlightenment and connectivity, between your characters, your readers, but also for yourself.
Yeah, it all has to be rooted in my own. I mean, this isn't autobiographical in any literal way, but it has to reflect what I'm going through or what I'm feeling. Otherwise, I don't know how else to get the feeling into the book. I have to feel it. I have to have known it in order to be able to put it down the page at all in a way that doesn't feel fake. You know, so I mean, I can write a. I've never been in a fight, but I could describe a fight. I've never flown an aircraft, you know, so I don't know what that's like. But okay, fine. But you know, then don't make that the center of the story. Make that part of something bigger. But the center needs to be, at least for me, I don't want to prescribe to anybody, but to me, I want the center to have a kind of emotional integrity that feels totally genuine. You know, I mean, it's not that because being fantasy, horror, weird fiction, they're not just a bunch of nonsense. You know, I mean, a lot of my most intense experiences reading, feelings of real emotional truth have come from books that are fantastical or horror books or whatever. You know, like the best writing usually has that kind of real core in it. Like Stephen Graham Jones was talking, and he would say, like, when he would get stuck writing, he would just throw in something from his own life. You just learn how to do that. And it's like, yeah, it's the same thing. It's like you draw on your own life and your own experiences. That's what gives, that's how you bring it to life.
Yeah, I think that makes a big difference too. That's a great tip from Stephen to include when you get stuck to include something from your own life that helps kind of, get the ball rolling. Maybe it doesn't stay in there, but at least it's
Right.
helped you get over that hump.
Right.
Yeah.
So, Michael, so coming toward the end here, got to ask any other upcoming news or projects you like to share, after Pest and also after Weird Fiction?
Well, let's see. I mean, I do have a new novel I just finished. I'm probably still polishing it a little bit. I don't know what's going to happen with that yet. It might come out from Clash as well, depending. I guess it depends on how well Pest does. Then I also, well, I mean, I have a collection of stuff of stuff that has already been published called Visiting Maze that was just published like today by Centipede Press. But I think, unfortunately, I think it's all gone already. I don't know, but it may have already, it was like 300 copies, and I think they may all have gone already, so I don't know. I mean, I didn't know what was happening today,
Did
but
they
who
send you
knows?
at least a personal copy?
Well, sure, yeah. I mean,
Okay.
I'm just saying,
Okay.
like, I mean, I got mine. I'm just saying, you know, it's like, if people want to go find it, I think it may be too late already, but you never know. Like, these things could come back out in paperback or even on PDF. So, yeah, that's kind of where it is right now. You know, I have a couple of fantasy book novels too that are finished. So I'm not quite sure where those end up, but they're set in the same world as The Narrator, which is a book I published a few years back. So they're not a trilogy or anything. They're just different novels set in that world. Actually, it goes back to the Traitor, come to think of it. So four novels on that world. I must be hooked on it. So they're, you know, but I'm always writing something, you know, so I've already got some ideas for, I got an idea for something I might start working on soon. So at present, the next thing up will be Pest, and then I guess Visiting Maze is the Centipede collection if you see it anywhere. Maybe some people are buying it to sell it again. I don't know. Also, New Maps of Dream, I think, is a collection that was just, that was long in the works. Joe, the late lamented wonderful Joe Pulver, put it together originally, and then Cody Goodfellow took it over and put it out. I just got my hard copy. It's got a lot of really talented writers in it. I think it's PS Publishing doing that, so if you keep your eyes open, I have a story in there. So that's where I'm.
We did an episode on New Maps of Dream. We also interviewed a couple authors from it, like Karen Warren and Christina
Right.
Morgan. And that is a great book. Nick Mamatas, who is one of the contributors to it, put us in touch with Cody Goodfellow to help, promote that book. But
Right.
I believe what happened was there was a signature page that got lost in the mail, so they had to resend
Yep.
all that stuff out,
That's
which caused
right.
it to be a little late.
That's right. Yes, they did vanish somewhere along the line. So we actually had to fill out two different sets of signature pages for the book. That did slow it down a bit. That's like the vicissitudes of the mail. I mean, this was, there were, it was, it's an international project. There are writers from all over the world contributing to it. And so it's like that, it gives you a lot of opportunities for things to go where they shouldn't.
And particularly time, it was during the pandemic too, I think that
Exactly.
all that was going on.
Yeah, that didn't help.
No, that was a excellent book. Different takes on the dreamlands that just weren't like, here's a whole bunch of Ulfar stories everywhere and everything. There's a lot of
Yes.
interesting takes on it.
Yeah.
Well, we'll let you go. So, Michael, thanks so much for coming on and being part of HP Lovecast. We again crossing fingers for Weird Fiction. And also I know Pest comes out a little bit later this month, although when this episode drops, it'll be in the past from Clash Books, but wishing it and you continued success.
Thank you both very much for having me.
Welcome back. Our second transmission is with J. Rocky Calavito. Calavito has been a longtime academic writer and teacher about exploitation and genre cinema. He joins us today to talk about his recently released giallo-inspired novel, The Night Scavengers. Welcome, Rocky.
Vince Lucchetti banged through the glass front door, body-checking a banger who was exiting. Banger looked at him like he wanted to start something. Lucchetti's glance finished it. Banger averted his gaze and went on his way. Lucchetti eyed the restaurant in front of him. Horseshoe counter, unoccupied. Booths lining the walls at a right angle, empty. The entry and hostess stand mark the intersection. Doors to the restrooms to his front, down the alley formed by the wall and the booths. A gap between the wall and the horseshoe counter for waitresses to pass. A curvy, busty waitress who was talking to the cook through the pass-through, and a lone man hunched in a booth to the right. Halfway down on the other side of the angle, plate glass to the occupant's left. Lucchetti leered at the waitress, who blushed and looked down to avoid the gaze that was viciously tearing her clothes off. He licked his lips. Coffee, black and fresh. That pot looks like it's been there a while. Make a new pot. He walked toward the occupied booth and slid in. There was an empty cup in front of the man, who was lost in the act of running his fingers over a book on the table in front of him. Good evening, detective, the man said without looking up. Lucchetti swatted the book away from him. It splatted on the floor face down in a puddle. Pay attention. I need intel. What kind of intel? There's all kinds of stories to tell about what happens around here. You know what I'm talking about. Which what are you referring to? I'm getting sick of this game. Tell me what you know. Detective, I have no idea what you are talking about, really. I'm quite willing to what I know about what you want, but you aren't giving me enough. Waitress approached, head bowed, carrying a mug and the pot filled with fresh coffee. She set the mug in front of Lucchetti and freshened the mug in front of the man being questioned. Everything in this part of town is mine, including you, Lucchetti said. Want me to demonstrate? No, I'm quite convinced. You were asking about the killer, yes? Yes. What do you have? Very little. The flotsam and jetsam that is forced to call this part of the city home refer to him as Rembrandt because of the perversely artistic nature of how he leaves the bodies. Everybody is pairing up for night activity. The ladies of the evening are making a killing for three ways. The clubs that can afford extra security have added it. The other ones open at their own risk, like this place. All old news, except for the thing about the hookers, which we'll bear looking into. Has anyone seen or heard anything? It was just another body dump not too far from here. Not a whisper. Where exactly did you find the body? In an alley near 44th and Gloucester. The only thing I've heard is about an abandoned minivan with a rather interesting hood ornament. The buildings that abut the alley on each side are fallen in. One's been burned down. Rats won't even touch the other one. I've been told they call that alley the latrine because it's a way stop for those needing immediate relief. Is that what you're referring to? Was the vehicle left there? So essentially, this is a waste of my time. As I said, I'm sorry to not have more for you. I'll keep my ears open, though, and you will be the first person I contact. You do that, Lucchetti said. Lucchetti slid out of the booth and cracked his neck by twisting his head. Put my coffee on his tab, he hollered at the waitress, who shrunk back in fear. Lucchetti leered again and walked over to her. He stepped behind the counter and grabbed her wrists.
We're joined this evening with Rocky Calavito, author of The Night Scavengers. Rocky, it's fantastic to see you. How are you doing, sir?
I am wonderful, and it is my honor to be on this podcast with both of you. This is actually the first time I've ever been interviewed or something like this.
Oh, very cool. Well, we're glad that we're able to help you out and have you on the show. Folks that are listening, you know, Rocky and us go way back. He's been a presenter at the Ann RadCon, a contributor to the horror literature from Gothic to Postmodern book. And he's just an all around cool guy who really knows his grindhouse and exploitation films. Also, on the subject of grindhouse and exploitation, you have a book out called The Night Scavengers, a neo-giallo film. So why don't you tell us about it?
Okay, well, as you mentioned, Nick, I'm kind of immersed in all matters grindhouse, partly because when I grew up, I didn't have access to these sorts of theaters. I lived in Western New York. I grew up in Western New York. We had some grindhouse theaters downtown Rochester that showed different kinds of films. But what always interested, different kinds of grindhouse films, excuse me. What interested me was the ads. Some of them just imprinted and stuck with me. I remember vividly seeing the ad for Trip with the Teacher, which was a very early Zalman King movie that was playing at the local drive-in. And the tagline was, how far will a teacher go to protect her students? And that just kind of stuck with me. And when I got to the point where I was a little bit more aware of film studies and whatnot, I picked up a copy of a book called Incredibly Strange Films. It's yes. Number 10 in the research collection. And in there, I discovered lots of great writing, elevated popular writing, not fully scholarly, and lots of interview space afforded to people like Herschel Gordon Lewis, David Friedman, Ray Dennis Steckler, Russ Meyer, all these filmmakers that did films that played the grindhouses. And so that was basically the start. You can blame Incredibly Strange Films for me getting interested in this stuff. And so it was a matter of expanding the Colavito Holdings to get more and more books about films that academics didn't touch. And I knew about Dario Argento's work with some other stuff that I had read and was doing. And so when Personal Technology came out, I started renting those films. And I started with Argento. It was an incomplete journey because Four Flies on Grey Velvet wasn't readily available. That was kind of a grail for people that collected videotapes. I finally managed to get hold of a copy. It was a pretty beat up second or third generation copy. But those films kind of stuck with me. And once again, I find my way into this genre because of the titles. Okay. Four Flies on Grey Velvet. How are you not going to be interested in that? And then Lizard in a Woman's Skin. What Have You Done to Solange? Who Can Kill a Child?
Your Vice
Black Belly of the Tarantula. I'm sorry?
Oh, the one, I think it's called Your Vice is a Locked Door and I Have the Key or something like that.
Yes.
They have great titles.
Oh, yeah. And so I started looking for those. And I got, I went through a giallo phase where I was just reading and, reading them, watching them. Trying to find it, English translations of some of the books, and then going back to the inspirations for people like Argento, The Bird with the Crystal Plumage is based on a Frederick Brown pulp novel called The Screaming Mimi. And so it kind of all coalesced. I did some academic work on it. I did a presentation about Giallo at the 20th Century Literature Conference in Louisville. But it kind of went off the radar until Judas Sonnet, Otis Bateman, aka Travis Davis, and Brian Ferry did this trio of works. Judith does a thing where she gets together with three other extreme splatterpunk type writers, and they challenge each other to write, edit, and publish a novella in 10 days. And I'm a silly sort. I did the NaNoWriMo the month after it was scheduled just to see if I could do it. And I did that without any problems. So I said, okay, well, what challenge do we want to try now? And I said, well, that sounds kind of neat. They had just done the Splatter Crime series, which is in some ways a very big influence on the Night Scavengers. But none of the three really carried the giallo essence in them. So I emailed Judith, we're Facebook friends, and I said, can I coattail? And she was, of course, very, you know, very, very supportive, as were Brian and Travis. And she just said, you know, what were you thinking of? And I said, okay, this is what I'm thinking of. Y'all did Splatter Crime, and I can see a place within that for something that's giallo inspired. And she knows giallo. She's watched the films and everything, and she says that would be great. So drawing upon what I remember from those films and the scholarship that I'd read and just playing around with it, I envisioned characters and I envisioned a storyline that I think seemed consistent with giallo, and was able to incorporate the different tropes with a little bit more, shall we say, spice added to them. Everything you see in there is something that is giallo inspired, but because I wanted to write something extreme and splattery, I kind of turned up the volume a little bit. So what I think happened is a pretty fair homage to the giallo that builds on it and takes it beyond what some of these films actually were. You know, they're famous for very elaborate kills in Deep Red. There's a scene where somebody dies by getting their teeth bashed into a marble mantle or the side of a table. I forget exactly what it is, but it's pretty protracted and, you know, nasty. So, you know, and then there's twist endings, like perpetrators turn out to be not what you think they are. There are people who, by and large, are kind of reprehensible. Either it's an authority figure who's corrupt, or it's somebody who's peripheral to the story. The characters, by and large, in here are pretty unlikable, except for one, and then he factors into the twist. So basically, it's an homage, and there's two more coming. I finished the second one, which is called Shards of Shattered Dolls. That one is a police procedural type giallo.
I'm going to mispronounce this. The Polichet, whatever. I'm an Italian scholar. I'd be able to say this stuff, but the Polichettis are the, yeah. No, the those are great films. You'd mentioned the research book on incredibly strange films. I have that book too. Big influence on me as well. I have a couple other research books, like industrial music and swing music and stuff.
I have all of them.
They're good stuff. I mean, they were, you know, first types of scholarship before we got to the scholarship we have now. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, incredibly strange music and the two zine books. Mm-hmm. They're very good too.
Rocky, you were talking about the films and so forth as being an inspiration for Night Scavengers. Is there other elements that kind of provided a genesis to the story as well that you haven't covered?
I owe a big debt to Judith Sonnett, Brian Berry, and Otis Bateman / Travis Davis for the splatter crime series. I wouldn't have been, they helped me. Hello, Kat. They helped me capture the essence of the setting. All right. Which, I made the setting a little, a little less, front-loaded in there in the Night Scavengers, because I wanted to focus more on the characters and really, not that you necessarily would want to know them, but deal with the characters rather than the settings. All right. I've been down 42nd Street when it was 42nd Street. I remember bits and pieces of the trip, like the barkers outside of the porn, of the grindhouses that showed porn, that type of thing, being accosted, being asked if I wanted to buy a woman or buy drugs or something like that. Yeah, that happened. But I didn't remember that all that well. All right. And so I said, well, you can get voice, you can get characters, and you can build part of a world that the characters inhabit that isn't necessarily as important as these other elements for the book. So that's kind of what I shot for. Some of the giallos are very isolated. The third one in the series that I'm going to do is set at a college. All right. For the giallos, they would set them at boarding schools. All right. Who Can Kill a Child is on an island. So the setting in those is downplayed. For mine, the setting is going to be a big part. For the third one, it's called Some Classes at Night. I'm kind of punning on. You can either say Corey Hart or Dwight Pullen. Okay. Yeah. Actually, I think I made a mistake on that. The title is Some Classes After Dark.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
Probably my favorite giallo set in a boarding school. It's Antonio Margheriti's Naked You Die. That's a great one.
Oh, yeah.
So we got Night Scavengers. You've referenced Buck Naked that you write for a pulp magazine. You also do some nonfiction writing. So, Rocky, aside from like your history of, getting video nasties and whatnot, what's some other where you draw your inspiration from, where you want to write about, be it fiction or nonfiction?
Well, if it's horror, I'm writing it right now. I'm going to be retiring in 2 years, provided neither one of us gets like super sick that we need to keep the insurance, or the stock market takes a huge dive and we don't have enough to go and do this. I have basically, other than the piece that you have solicited from me, pretty much stopped writing scholarly articles. I'm still doing presentations here and there. I have to get my Ayn Rand abstract in pretty soon. I'm going to do something on the movie The Menu. Talking about food and horror, and this one's going to be about food fetishism, food porn, and security, because this is a case of where we have a privileged class forming most of the patrons in this particular restaurant, and the fact that it's so exclusive works as a metaphor for food insecurity. All right. And the fetishization and really the pornography associated with it are what's basically killed the chef's interest. And he was a more mainstream chef. I mean, we know the story of the film, not to give away spoilers, but he has a connection to regular people food. All right. Not this haute cuisine. And so I think there's some pretty interesting things to talk about in there. Right now I'm teaching a class in professional wrestling, and I write for first set in the world of professional wrestling. I've become connected to a local professional wrestling organization. I go to their shows. I went to their open house, nearly broke my neck trying to do something in the ring. And so they, I've done, you know, so I have a professional wrestling set horror story, for instance, which is out in the current Grindhouse Resurrection, which parenthetically, Nick, you might want to pick up because there is a fairly extensive Emmanuel article in there.
Send me the link. I'll definitely check it out. And also, folks who are, you know, heard earlier about Rocky submitting something to me, that's for my Emmanuel, Black Emmanuel call for papers, which as of this podcast coming out is still open for another month. So listeners who want to submit and write about Emmanuel films, please do. Especially since, yeah, you'll be sharing.
Yeah, the article, if I'm remembering correctly, focuses on Emmanuel in America.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But yeah, it's good. I will, after we're done here, I'll send you the link through here. You'll order it straight from Pete.
Cool.
And I should say that anybody who wants to get a copy of Grindhouse Resurrection, which you should do, not just because I'm in there, but because it's probably one of the most informed treatments of the Grindhouse era. It's done by Pete Chiarella, a.k.a. 42nd Street Pete, a.k.a. 42P. And he's doing yeoman's work keeping this stuff vital. I can't recommend it or his work enough. If you are into this genre, you need to be reading 42P, watching his videos on YouTube. He has his own YouTube channel. You'll learn something, trust me.
Can do.
So that was you know, that's the professional wrestling thing. I'm teaching you that right now. I'm doing a class on horror and diversity. You know, taking my life in my hands, you know, white cis straight guy talking about diversity, and my response is, well, who else is stepping up to do it here? So I'm doing that, and so I've gotten interested in diversity in horror, given my movement towards horror creative writing. I am using this as an opportunity to try to get insight into how to write diverse characters. All right. Without making them out to be victims or villains or anything like that. So I'm working on it. I wouldn't consider myself an expert yet, but I'm working on it. And I got time. So, you know, it becomes trial and error. It becomes trial and error with it. So first thing I ever did, first presentation I ever did at a conference was on splatterpunk. I was a first wave splatterpunk reader. And then I kept with it. Then I went to zombies. And so that's how I got into the inaugural collection of papers that originated at Ann Rad that you two did. And then it's just basically, you know, I have the attention span of a fruit fly. I mean, really, really, this creative writing thing is the first thing that has managed to keep my attention, even though I'm flitting all over the place in terms of genre. You know, so, I mean, there's where you get the thing about food. I did a presentation on the platform a couple summers ago. You know, so I'm really bad, okay? I go to a movie or I read a book and I still can't quite turn off my scholarly side. And so, I mean, okay, my son and I went to see Coke Yogi last weekend. Cocaine Bear. Mm-hmm. And I really didn't like it. It was too much of a, it, It was a hybrid, and it didn't succeed on either genre that it was trying to hybridize. It wasn't funny, and it wasn't scary enough, and it was impossible for me to suspend my disbelief. I mean, I'm sorry. I don't care how close to a ton a mature black bear weighs. I don't know anything on the face of the planet that can eat a whole 12-pound brick of cocaine and live. You know, but I mean, there is stuff that can be talked about in there, because now the asylum is doing something called Attack of the Meth Gator.
Of course, asylum.
Oh man.
There was 12 years ago, there was a film called Crackoon, which was about a raccoon that gets addicted to crack. And we played a game with this in my horror writing class. Okay, I said, you have two words. One of them has to be an addictive illicit drug. And then the second has to be an animal of some kind. And you get extra points if you can alliterate it. So we're throwing stuff out there and everything. And then I make them write a pitch for it. And I'm playing along. And what do I come up with? Freebase Fatalis. You know what a Fatalis is?
No.
Smilodon Fatalis, saber-toothed tiger.
Oh, okay.
So what I have concocted that I'm going to write it sometime, I'm in a creature feature phase right now. I'll tell you that. I'll tell you about that a little later. But I am going to write that as a novella. And I describe it as, this is Pleistocene Park meets Cocaine Bear. And it's going to be set at this genetics laboratory where they've managed to recreate a Smilodon Fatalis. And its handler is a crack addict, Freebase. And he's so addicted that his body has become saturated with the remnants and all sorts of nasty things. And the Smilodon Fatalis kills him and eats him. And then gets addicted from doing that. And so then it becomes one of your standard asylum type movies where it's like, it got out. Let's see if we can catch it. Which, of course, is the basic conflict, which is, no, we're not going to catch it. We're going to kill it. You know, so it's weird where this stuff comes out. So, I mean, you know, yeah, I trashed Cocaine Bear to my students, alienated one of them who loved it. But, you know, something good comes out of that. So really it's a lot. It's inspirations that come from things that I interact with, whether it's popular culture, whether it's the news, whether it's scholarship, whether it's movies, that's why I have such a fleeting attention span, is because I'll chase the bright, shiny object. You know? like cats and puppies do, because that kind of, you know, something new will come along and it's like, well, hey, that sounds really interesting. Let me kill some brain cells on that. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, where does the inspiration come from? Sometimes it's just something that I watched the other day, or something that I read on Facebook. Or something that I ran across surfing online on scholarly networks. It's a lot of things.
Well, that's actually a good point, Rocky, because when we were kind of in the green room before starting this interview, you know, one of the things that you mentioned is that you're very open on social media, particularly on Facebook. And as friends of yours, you know, we see your daily posts where you're very overt about your writing process, sharing accomplishments, your work counts, and things like that. So how does that inspire or help your writing?
It keeps me doing it for one thing. My wife and I are now in the stage of, do you really have to go and write at 10 o'clock at night? And it's like, yeah, I didn't finish my 2,000 words a day. That's my thing right now. Last year, the new year, I started the new year with the first resolution that I've ever kept. I said, I want to write 1,000 words a day.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I accomplished that with many words to spare. And I said, okay, I want to double that. And I haven't missed a day this year. It's become a point of honor with me to say that, no, it is. I mean, I don't want to sound arrogant about it or anything like that. But it's, you know, I'm pretty damn proud of the fact that I stuck to this and that I'm continuing to stick to this, regardless of how tired I am, regardless of how afflicted with monkey brain I am. This actually turns off the monkey brain. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, I'm not real good at promoting myself. Okay. I was talking with Ryder Kinley. I don't know if you know her. She's based in Australia, and we've become Facebook friends, and we've talked a couple times on the phone, and she critiqued me in terms of how well I promote. Okay. As far as things go in the world of writing, I'm nobody. I mean, I'm known within the group of people that I was in this writing group with. It's called Fright Club. I can't go into detail about it, but it was a major, major motivator, supporter, and affirmer for me, because nobody ever in my life ever really complimented the work that I do. Mm-hmm. Because it's been felt that this, I mean, not you all, you all have been great and supportive and everything, but I'm talking about the people that I work with.
Right.
Okay. I've never been, you know, it's like, I always get the, that's really nice. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I've never really been, not that I care, mind you, but I never get recognized for this. Okay. And so, you know, I kind of am like, okay, well, I do this for me, you know, I do this for a very narrow group. And, you know, if somebody else wants to know about it, that's great. But I never really go out of my way to promote it. Mm-hmm. This is my tentative, you know, my daily accountability is my tentative steps of promoting myself. Promoting the fact that I am working, maybe demonstrating that a busy person can still produce work. I don't do it for the affirmations. If someone reads my posts and thinks, well, hey, that's, if he can do it, I can do it, that's great. But it's also something that is a check on me. I'm to the point right now where I would feel pretty damn embarrassed if I had to report, and I would, I couldn't do it today. Mm-hmm. You know, I a lot of it is for myself. All right. You know, and I just don't, I've never felt that I've done something that I've been proud enough to say, I did this, until I started writing horror.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, I'm real willing to tell people that I've never had as good a life as I'm leading right now in the 2 years that I've been actively writing horror. So that's basically where it comes from. It's like, I know there's this thing out there of, you know, people posting their word counts and everything. I'm going to keep doing it, because it's for me. All right. It's for me. And I can go back at some point and say, you were really kicking along right there. All right.
I really
can. And I like to brag about how well I do at Wordle.
You know, I really commend you on that, Rocky, because I think it wasn't last year, it was the year before that I did NaNoWriMo, and it was the first time that I really committed to it and stuck with it. And like you, just for the month, every day I posted, because it was, like you said, it's a check-in for yourself, you know, keeping yourself accountable and making it public, you know. And it's not to get the that a girl or that a boy or anything like that.
But you did get a shirt.
I did get a shirt. No, just feeling a sense of accomplishment because I did it, you know. And I don't think, like you, if I wasn't checking in every day on my Facebook feed to say I got it done, I don't know that I would have actually done it. So yeah, I totally hear and completely understand what you mean. It really is a sense of accomplishment, and it really does. It feeds your desire and your passion of wanting to accomplish.
There's another thing about it too. I teach a creative writing horror class for non-majors. I get some creative writing majors in it because our program is lit fic oriented, and they don't get many opportunities to write genre fiction in their classes. And one of the things that I impress upon them is that writing a book is as intimidating as you want to make it. But if you break it down like this, okay, the average length of a novel is between 90 and 120,000 words. Okay. At 1,000 words a day, you've got a draft of a novel in 4 months. And then you've got the rest of the year to tweak, edit, and pitch, and then see what happens. You know, you can write 3 books, and these are pretty chunky novels, in a year if you just commit to writing 1,000 words a day. So that's another thing that I'm trying to do, is I'm trying to demonstrate, because I post my monthly totals too. I'm just trying to demonstrate for people that while it is daunting and while it is not easy, this is a way that you can get over the fear of the blank page. Mm-hmm. And as you said, Michelle, that's a pretty big rush finishing NaNoWriMo.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's 1,667 words a day for 30 days. All right. As an average. And so it's like what I tell my students at the end of the horror writing class, when they've finished the short story, they start it with a 6-word story, a la Hemingway, for sale, baby shoes, lightly used, never worn. And by the end of the semester, they've blown that up into a short story. And we spend the last week of class reading from them. They turn in the final version at the final. But on the last day of class, after the last person has read, what I tell them is, you've now accomplished something that 90% of the population says they wish they could do. They have it on their bucket list. Congratulations. You've written a piece of fiction.
Yes.
It's a very optimistic and positive way to look at it, that's for sure.
And it's empowering. It's empowering. Yeah. I like what you know, you're not the first one to say that writers are not getting really opportunities to write in genre. So your class sounds very important in the grand scheme of learning to write and being empowered by your writing.
Yeah. And you'd be surprised at the quality of some of the work that I get out of there. I had a student who won a contest that Maurice Broaddus judged. I had someone win an award for a piece that she published in our student literary magazine. I had someone publish a drabble in a bound collection. I've had people turn this stuff into actual publications. So, you know, I mean, and I mean, they did it on their own talent. I'm just like, you know, I'm just like the conductor on the Polar Express with this. But, you know, there's a definite place for it. And I wish it was, I mean, I wish it was taken a little bit more seriously. I wish they had more opportunities. Basically, that's what I do at Butler, where I teach, is I'm the one that, you know, organizes and delivers the Halloween event where students can come and read from their work, and you know, we can talk about scary stories and whatnot. Next year, I'm going to propose that I do a one credit independent study that's rooted in the NaNoWriMo. And I'm just going to say, hey, do you want to do this contest? Here's what you have to do. You get one credit hour for doing this.
Oh, that's a great idea.
And you get a book out of
Yes.
You get a short book out of it.
Okay, you get a short, yeah. Well, little one.
well, if you write more than 1,666 words, you'll get a longer book. If you're that ambitious.
Interesting thing about this, okay? I self-published a book like 15 days after The Night Scavengers Streeted. It's a professional wrestling horror thing called Whatever Happened to Hell's Bells. It's about the disintegration of a tag team that is two women. And it's basically, you know, a jealousy type thing with some other nastiness thrown into it. But that was novella length when, you know, on my computer when I did it. When I went to reformat it was almost 200 pages.
Wow.
It's two novellas.
193 pages. You know, it's again, it's called Whatever Happened to Hell's Bells. And it's available on Amazon right now. Same deal as Night Scavengers. It's $2.99 in Kindle. Got Green Acres on the brain here. $2.99 on Kindle and $8.99 for the paperback. And I will throw out there, you know, you can, if there are people out there that want a copy for review purposes, you can give them my email and I'll be more than happy to post them one. Let's just put it this way. Sending them to people is not a problem for me. And I can't say anything more. I can't say anything more.
All righty.
But yeah, and the same thing goes for the first Buck Naked novel. I was going to send y'all a copy of that anyway because y'all are friends, and I think you know Doc, don't you, Nick?
I don't think so. What's
Clancy, Michael Pfeiffer, you know Java. You know Java, right?
Yeah, from Bachelor Pad.
Yeah. Now that's an interesting story, okay? I first submitted the Buck Naked story that started all this to Bachelor Pad, and Java didn't want it. He said, we don't do this kind of stuff. He said, but my friend Doc over at Caveman Mike, here's his contact information. So I pitched it to Doc. He liked it. He liked the story, and he said, you got any more of this? And I said, well, I could see it becoming a series. And so the first part of it, which was the deep series, all the titles had a variation of the word deep in there and the word depravity, you know, some variation on that, was four stories. And then he says, you got any more? And I'm like, strange that you ask. We're working on the second one, you know, we're working through the second one right now. Issue 10 is due to Street in weeks. He's at a con right now. And so then he says, well, you know, you ever think about writing a book? And I'm like, so funny you asked. I'm working on his origin story. And so that's coming out next week. I have the second Buck Naked novel in edits right now. I have the third one, which is nearly ready to go, but I've got to get the second one in before the third one. And I've already finished the third series for Caveman, which is, it's a werewolf story, but it's not a werewolf. And I've started the fourth Buck Naked novel. And I have also, my fertile brain has concocted a whole group called the Danger Five, of which Buck Naked is one of them. And I'm writing a convergent story with all five of them that's set at a version. It's kind of a cross between the Consumer Electronics Show and a big ass popular culture convention in Vegas.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. So anyway, Doc liked it. And that's how Buck Naked came into being. It was, I talk a lot, you know, when people talk to me about my experience, I'm like, a lot of it's just luck. Mm-hmm. Seriously. You know, Java doing me the solid of sending me to Doc. That's why he's mentioned in the dedication of the book. Okay. You know, I happened to be talking with the publisher of the guy who runs Psychotoxin Press about something. He ran a contest where we did an ABCs of Horror type of thing, and I wrote a story for that. And then he wanted to do another one that was an ABCs of Horror story about fear of clowns. Well, that one didn't pan out, but he really liked the story that I wrote, so you know, he wanted to feature it on the website and everything. And we got to talking, and he just asked what I was doing and if I had anything else. And I said, well, you know, I've got this professional wrestling story. You know, it's 2000 Maniacs meets Southern Regional Wrestling. Mm-hmm. And so I'd like to see it, you know, and I sent it to him and he's like, we want to publish this. It's coming out in August. All right. Would you believe that he got a wild hair a week or so ago and said, I want to publish something today. He threw this out on Facebook and I just happened to see it. I want to publish something today. I had something. I've had it with somebody for a year. I haven't heard Jack or his sibling squat about it. So I submitted it to him and he published it that very day. It's called The Swamp Siren. You can find it at Psychotoxin Press. It's in ebook. All right. Dumb luck. Dumb luck. All right. And I mean, a connection turned me on to this collection that is being published by a press that publishes her. I'm publishing a cryptid story there.
Oh, cool.
This guy named Al Vermette brought back Werewolf Magazine. There used to be a zine in like the early 2000s called Werewolf Magazine. Well, he's brought it back. It's Werewolf Magazine Reborn. I had a Fright Club story. They try to do transformation stories in this, werewolves, that kind of thing. I happen to have a transformation story from my experience in Fright Club. It's about a woman who is a were shark. I submitted it and he took it for the first. I had two more. He's accepted both of those. Dumb luck. All right. Last one. Alien Buddha Press is putting out a collection on professional wrestling. And I think they were looking for things to finish it. I mean, my friend Rebecca Cuthbert published her collection of poems. It's called, oh God, I just blanked on the title. Sorry, Rebecca. I knew about the press and I just happened to, I was cruising Facebook and I said, And I saw it and I said, well, okay, what, why the hell not? I had a wrestling story that was inspired by an Alice Cooper song that was submitted for Burt Edens did a collection called Dismembering the Coop. He liked it. He didn't want it. Mm-hmm. So I had it sitting around. I submitted it. I heard back in an hour with an acceptance. Dumb luck. I seem to have a lot of luck placing my stuff that gets rejected in something else. So
keep a stockpile of your stuff, folks.
Well, I'm slowly depleting the wood pile, and I've got to get back in that. What I've found is I have a real problem hitting the sweet spot with short stories. They always start getting away from me, and they turn into novellas. You know, and I'm like, I got something that's, you know, 8,000 words, and it has to be 5, and I'm just like, okay, I'm gonna do this. How am I gonna do this? You know, but like I said, and this is what I tell the students, and this is what I tell anybody that's trying to make it. Some of it's just luck. All right. And luck comes in bunches. All right. Here's another one. Here's another luck story. Okay. This summer, I spotted a call for zombies, for zombie stories. Mm-hmm. The close was in 1 week. I didn't have anything. I said, but I got to try for this. I know so much about zombies. I've taught classes about it. I published with you, you know. So I got to try this. What I did have lying around was the screenplay for a short film. It was about a UFO that crashes in rural New Mexico. And when it crashes, it hits this I'm drawing a blank on the damn word. It hits a storage area for bioweapons. And the crash kills all the occupants in the UFO. But it also breaches a canister of reanimation agent. So there's a scene in the short film where you see this three clawed hand fall into frame. You see it get, you know, covered by this yellow mist, and then you see it twitch. I blew that up into a story. This is with Wicked Shadow Press. Oh, they've cool. I've submitted to four of their calls, and I've gotten into every one.
That's fantastic.
Dumb luck just from finding it. Okay. Sometimes you just have to make your own luck.
And that's that perseverance.
Well, Rocky, you've had a lot of dumb but awesome luck this year so far. Again, congrats on the Night Scavengers coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to ask your upcoming projects, but you have nailed it. You are a busy guy. So we want to say thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing with us what you've got coming out, and also about the Night Scavengers. And, you know, continue good luck for you, sir. It's always good to see your projects when they come out. And, you know, we wish you continued success.
And that concludes our transmissions for this episode. We'd like to thank Laura Synth for providing the bumper for today's episode. We interviewed Laura in her Bram Stoker-nominated novel, The Clackety, last summer. Her sequel, The Night Housekeeper, will be published this October.
In April, we will be discussing the 1970 film, The Dunwich Horror, directed by Daniel Holler and starring Dean Stockwell and Sandra Dee. I know y'all been waiting for this one.
Arrow Films recently restored and re-released the film in high-definition Blu-ray, so we thought it was high time to review this film and see how it stacks up as an adaptation of the H.P. Lovecraft story by the same name. And as for our transmissions episode at the end of the month, we'll be focused on comic book creators Joshua Pruitt and Bernie Gonzalez.
Yeah. So please contact us if you'd like to be a guest on Transmissions. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Our website is hplovecast.com, and of course you can email us at hplovecast@gmail.com. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and feel free to explore our archives. Consider supporting us by purchasing our books. We each have Amazon author pages with links to all the books that we've either edited or contributed to with individual essay chapters. Or if you feel like donating a dollar or two, we do have a Ko-fi account. A link is provided in the show notes. As always, thank you for listening.